This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Israel has said that 5 days is too long and that they're afraid that in 5 days Hamas will be able to re-equip and rearm. They're also afraid that they'll sort of lose the momentum and there will be during that 5 days growing international pressure.
That's a reporter Linda Gradstein on reports of a possible deal for Hamas to release some of its Israeli hostages in exchange for a 5-day ceasefire in Gaza. Details coming up. Also, voters in Liberia's runoff presidential election say the process has been smooth today. And health experts warn that diabetes could become one of the biggest killers on the continent. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. A short time ago, U.S. President Joe Biden said he has been in daily conversations with international partners on freeing more than 240 hostages Hamas militants took from Israel last month. He said his message to the families of hostages is, hang in there. He said he expected a deal would happen, but did not give any details. Also today, the United Nations Humanitarian Office, known as OCHA, said fighting between Israeli troops and Palestinian militants in northern Gaza caused 200,000 people to flee south in the past 10 days. OCHA also said at least 60% of hospitals in the territory no longer function. Some of the fighting is around hospitals where patients, newborns, and medics are stranded with no electricity and dwindling supplies. Israel accuses Hamas of using hospitals as cover for its fighters, alleging that Hamas has set up its main command center in and beneath Shifa Hospital, the largest in the besieged territory. Both Hamas and Shifa Hospital staff deny the Israeli allegations. More than two-thirds of Gaza's population of 2.3 million have fled their homes since the war began on October 7th, when Hamas fighters attacked communities in Israel, killing more than 1,200 people. The fighters also hold about 240 people hostage in Gaza. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says nearly 12,000 residents of the enclave have died. For more on the latest developments in the conflict, I spoke earlier with my colleague Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. So, Linda, Israeli forces have reached the gates of Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa. What is the significance? What is being reported there?
So the fighting is very heavy around the hospital, and there are several thousand people still in the hospital, both patients and doctors and some people who haven't left despite all of the, you know, Israeli warnings to do so. And Israel says that it has offered to help the get the premature babies from the incubators and take them to another hospital. Israel also released footage today from a nearby hospital, not from Shifa Hospital, but from Rantisi Hospital, which is a pediatric children's cancer hospital, of an underground tunnel under the hospital and weapons that were found there and a room that Israel says looks like the hostages could have been held there. There were diapers and a baby bottle, and it was empty when they found it. And obviously, you know, that supposedly the hostages had been moved. And I think it just sort of reminded me, at least, of the fact that there are babies in captivity without their parents. It's now 39 days. So it's just sort of hard to imagine that.
So Shifa is the Gaza's largest and best equipped hospital. And is there any evidence for Israeli claims that the facility also is used by Hamas for military purposes?
Well, Israel has been saying this for a long time, and they've released, you know, some footage that they say, for example, there is a square opening just outside the hospital that they say they believe leads to an underground tunnel. Palestinians say it's a water reservoir and not an underground tunnel, and I think that's why they released this footage from the Rantisi Hospital to show that at least, you know, that they know that hospitals are being used as, you know, for underground and for sheltering Hamas, and that therefore Hamas is really holding the population of Gaza like human shields. But I don't know that we have concrete proof that the same situation exists at Shifa, although it is certainly plausible.
And you said, you know, the fighting is raging, but President Joe Biden has said that Gaza's largest hospital must be protected and called for less intrusive action by Israeli forces. You think they will heed that suggestion?
Well, you know, the thing is, the Shifa Hospital, I mean, I've been there. It's right in the middle of the city. It's not that it's any place else. And, you know, if you look at the footage that's coming out of Gaza, whole neighborhoods have been leveled, have been destroyed. Even once the fighting ends, you know, I don't know where the Palestinians who fled the north are going to be able to go back to. Former Chief of Staff Benny Gantz, who recently joined the government, today said that even if Israel pauses the fighting as part of a potential hostage deal, it will continue pursuing its war to dislodge Hamas's control over Gaza. He said that Israel will continue until its goals are achieved, and that he said it aims to uproot Hamas's political and military control over the Strip. And Prime Minister Netanyahu has repeatedly said that Gaza after Hamas must be demilitarized and de-radicalized.
Has there been any progress in negotiations to release the hostages held in Gaza?
Well, a Hamas spokesman made a video that was posted on Telegram in which he said that Hamas is willing to release 70 of the hostages, apparently the women, children, and ill people, in exchange for a 5-day ceasefire. So that would be roughly, you know, a little more than a quarter of the hostages in exchange for the 5-day ceasefire. Israel has said that 5 days is too long, and that they're afraid that in 5 days Hamas will be able to re-equip and rearm. They're also afraid that they'll sort of lose the momentum, and there will be during that 5 days growing international pressure to stop the fighting. At the same time, the hostage families today started a march from Tel Aviv, which is where the hostage headquarters is, all the way to Jerusalem. It's going to take them 5 days, and earlier it was pouring rain before, so I'm sure it's not very pleasant to be doing that.
And lastly, Linda, in the United States yesterday, there were large protests calling for a ceasefire in Gaza in some cities, including Oakland, California, and Chicago. And there is a pro-Israeli rally today here in Washington, D.C. So how do people view such protests over where you are?
Well, I think, you know, that it depends, you know, which side you're on or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think for Palestinians to see Americans protesting like that, and it was, you know, very encouraging to them. I know many Israelis are very happy. They're expecting 60,000 people on the march in Washington today, which is quite a lot. So I think there's, you know, a feeling of, you know, support from, for example, for Israelis from the American Jewish community about this rally today. At the same time, I think that Israel says it's going to make its decisions kind of based on what it feels it needs to do. And of course, taking the opinion of President Biden and the United States into account, but not necessarily looking all that carefully at the public.
Linda Gradstein, updating us from Jerusalem. Thank you for your input.
Sure. Thank you.
So as you just heard, tens of thousands of protesters are expected at the March for Israel here in Washington, D.C. Security is tight around the National Mall near the U.S. Capitol, where demonstrators have been gathering. The organizers say the march is intended to show support for Israel and to condemn anti-Semitism. VOA's Anthony Labruto is on the mall, and we have him on the line now to give us an update on what's going on. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Anthony.
Hello, Yehia. Thank you very much.
So, the rally is just officially starting. Tell us what's happening.
So, the March for Israel rally has just started, as you said. But throughout the last hour, there have been several high-profile speakers speaking to the crowds here, including U.S. Congresswoman Vichy Torres, a Democrat from the state of New York, and Brett Gelman, a popular television star on the show Stranger Things. who have both come out in support of Israel and taken a really big first step in this rally in acknowledging that Israel has the right to defend itself, really in keeping with the rally so far. So additionally, there have been popular Israeli artists, musical artists that have performed on the main stage here. But after these introductory performances, there's going to be what the March for Israel rally is calling its freedom segment. We've got such a hearing right now. And so this is featuring several Jewish scholars and dissidents, political commentators. And so this is really just kicking off right now, as you're hearing.
So, Anthony, what's the crowd number looking like? And what is the security around the mall looking like?
Oh, absolutely. So the crowd, as I had reported on earlier, was expected to reach about 60,000. But to give you a little bit of a perspective of what that crowd looks like currently, there really wasn't that many people here compared to now. But so I'm at the base of the United States Capitol on the National Mall. And so this rally extends to the Washington Monument, which is about a mile away. And you know, so it is completely filled with people. The National Mall is absolutely full. And so with that being said, the visible security has also increased. The road closures are being strictly enforced with minimal to no car traffic surrounding the National Mall. I've seen various security teams escorting in and out those higher profile guests and speakers. And the coordination between those local and federal officers has created an atmosphere really of unity and support around these rally goers. There really isn't a lot of anxiety that I've seen so far from the rally goers, and that they can just protest and support Israel in the way that they want. And so the students that I spoke on earlier, too, had maintained that same momentum going to the start of the full rally here. And so along the main fence, that's the media area, there's collegiate students, young children, who are really free to support that Israeli cause.
So, Anthony, a mile-long crowd at the mall, that's a lot of people. What have people been saying as they headed to the rally?
Yes, as more people have joined the rally on the National Mall, the connectedness between America and Israel is incredibly apparent here. Now, there are signs from Baltimore on the eastern coast of America, Cleveland, Ohio, in the center of the country, and Philadelphia also on the eastern coast. There are pro-Israeli people from across America, and they've come together as sort of this extended family. They're also, they're currently singing actually the Star Spangled Banner. And a team that I've spoken to has really been grateful to the United States' support of Israel and would like it to continue even further in support of the peace of mind. And so the biggest topic that really has dominated the start of this rally, though, beyond those musical artists, have been the missing Israeli hostages that have been taken on October 7th. There's been an acknowledgement of those between, between those musical artists and their potential presence.
Anthony Labruto at the Washington National Mall covering the March for Israel. Liberians today voted in the nation's presidential runoff election between President George Weah and former Vice President Joseph Boakai. The two entered the runoff nearly neck and neck. Weah took 43.83% of the vote in the first round last month, and Boakai captured 43.44%. Earlier today, reporter Denise Nemtsen spoke with people about how the voting process went in Monrovia. Cornelius Toby Bowler says there weren't the delays seen in the October 10th first round.
And today process, smoothly, good, no shopping, no happy crowd, everything going on smoothly. So tell God thank you. It was not like the first round process. Now everything going on smoothly.
Moses Morlu says the kick to vote was much shorter today than in the first round.
Enter, no problem. Things are fine. I can't hear not too long. Police officer put everything under control. So right now, things are smooth inside there. No problem. The first round was too tough. Yeah, when I can't hear the first round, I stood on the line for almost 3 hours.
For more on the election, check out voaafrica.com. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. On World Diabetes Day today, experts warn the disease could be a leading cause of death in Africa by 2030. The latest statistics quoted by the World Health Organization shows there were over 400,000 diabetes-related deaths on the continent in 2021. Reporter Vicky Stark filed this report from Cape Town, South Africa.
World Diabetes Day marks the birthday of one of the scientists who discovered insulin and its use in treating diabetes, Sir Frederick Banting. The medication is used to treat millions of people around the globe living with this chronic disease. It occurs when the body can't effectively use the insulin it produces or the pancreas doesn't produce enough insulin. Type 1 diabetes is a genetic condition that usually begins in childhood and requires management with daily insulin injections and diet. Type 2 diabetes usually develops in adulthood and is linked to poor diet, obesity, and inactivity. It can be treated with insulin and other medications. People with both types of diabetes are at higher risk of heart attacks, strokes, kidney failure, blindness, and amputations. Despite its prevalence, funding to combat diabetes is a mere drop in the ocean when compared with communicable diseases like tuberculosis, malaria, and HIV. Dr. Kibacho Mwangi is the World Health Organization's advisor for non-communicable diseases in South Africa, where diabetes is already one of the leading causes of death.
You have to look at it from a global health security agenda. From the perspective of donors, it makes much more sense to contain infectious diseases, of course, but more and more development agencies are now supporting NCDs because it doesn't make sense to save an individual dying from an acute illness like HIV only for them to die of a stroke.
Mwangi says they're also encouraging governments to put additional money into fighting non-communicable diseases.
As the figure rises, we are adding more and more investment in the entire continuum, from prevention to treatment to long-term follow-up, and even in investing in surveillance to have some of these figures more accurate and more usable for policymaking.
Referring to this year's World Diabetes Day theme, which is access to diabetes care, know your risk, know your response, Mwangi urges people to get tested at least once a year. He says the earlier a person is diagnosed, the better. South African Helga Neft was diagnosed 16 years ago when she was pregnant.
There was first a series of tests and consultations. The physician even let me run on a treadmill with my belly. It was very confusing and emotional at the time for me, and I was really fearful, to be quite honest.
Today, she is thriving and counsels other diabetics about the importance of a healthy lifestyle.
Obviously, one has a medication regime that one follows. I try to get some form of exercise, whether that's been walking or stretching. My motto is just show up and move. Then also it's around the nutrition. So I try to be quite regular in terms of when I eat in the day. And the other important one is sleep.
Symptoms of diabetes include feeling very thirsty, needing to urinate more often than usual, blurred vision, feeling tired, and losing weight. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
The International Monetary Fund projects South Africa will soon overtake Nigeria to once again become Africa's largest economy. This comes despite South Africa's many crises, including a creaking electricity grid, poor service delivery, and the world's highest unemployment rate. Darren Taylor reports.
Some economists say South Africa's return to the top of the pile on the continent isn't because its economy is performing well. It's because Nigeria's and Egypt's are doing badly. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, expects South Africa's gross domestic product to rise above $400 billion next year, with Nigeria at $395 billion and Egypt around $360 billion. Standard Chartered Bank economist Razia Khan told a recent Business Day webinar the South African economy's been remarkably resilient to daily power cuts known as load shedding, but there are other challenges.
Of course, South Africa has been stuck in this place of weak growth for some time. But fast forward to 2024 and the possibility that load shedding eases very significantly and you do have a boost to growth. Nonetheless, there will be other headwinds for South Africa. The extent of Reserve Bank tightening that we've seen is going to be feeding through to the economy with a lagged effect. This has a big impact on consumer behavior, and the slowdown in the global economy still creates some level of uncertainty for South Africa.
The IMF says Nigeria is being hit by falling oil production, inflation, and the decreasing value of the Naira. But it forecasts Nigeria will bounce back to again be Africa's largest economy in 2025. President Bola Tinubu has revamped Nigeria's foreign exchange system, scrapped expensive gasoline subsidies, and boosted tax revenue. But, says Khan, a major challenge for Nigeria in 2024 is that its OPEC oil production quota could be cut significantly. Khan says Egypt's woes include slow industrial development, a crumbling currency, and weak institutions, meaning declining investment.
It's going to take quite a lot policy-wise to try to stabilize that. Nonetheless, there is still the belief that with export momentum, Egypt is within sight of stronger growth. There has been a real effort in Egypt on the fiscal side to try to deal with the debt overhang, to try to achieve a budget surplus.
In 2026, the IMF says Egypt will likely replace South Africa as the continent's second biggest economy, with billions of dollars in loans expected to spark reform and encourage investment. Some economists say the power grid collapse has eroded South Africa's manufacturing capacity and costs it billions of dollars every month. Wits University Business School professor Yanyu Rousseau tells VOA, decades of failed job creation policies and infrastructure collapse stifle growth.
In South Africa, we have problems with our railroads and we have problems with South African harbors. Fix the railroads, fix the harbors so that commodities can be exported, because that will boost economic activity in the case of South Africa. In the case of South Africa, we have a government that simply lacks the will to resolve these problems.
President Cyril Ramaphosa's administration says it has a comprehensive plan to improve infrastructure, including a complete restructuring of the railways. But Rousseau warns that unless this happens soon, South Africa will slip even further down the ladder. Other African economies are growing fast, he says, while South Africa's growth is very slow. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
International prosecutors say Alois Ndambita, one of the last remaining fugitives wanted over the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, has been confirmed dead. The International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda indicted Ndambati on 7 counts relating to the mass killings of around 800,000 people, most of them Tutsis and moderate Hutu, over 100 days. These charges included genocide, murder, rape, and persecution. The Office of the Prosecutor at the International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals, the successor to the UN Tribunal, says it was able to conclude, following a comprehensive and challenging investigation, that Ndambati died by around the end of June 1997. It says the exact circumstances of his death in Gatori in southeastern Rwanda have not been determined, owing to the confusion and absence of order at the time. The prosecutor's office says only two outstanding criminal tribunal fugitives remain, Charles Sikubambo and a former businessman called Ryan Dikayo. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Tien Wang, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.